Today's Tay Show will be on Case 72 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu. Case 72 is Ungans, do you have them or not? Main subject, Hyakujo asked Ungan, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? Ungan said, Osho, do you have them or not? Hyakujo said, my successors will be missing. Secho's verse, Osho, do you have them or not? The golden-haired lion does not crouch. In twos and threes they go the old way. The master of Mount Tayu snaps his fingers in vain. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen together. It's so wonderful to practice together. It makes such a big difference. You look at the screen and everybody's absolutely still. And even if you feel like moving, you don't move. It's really magical. And everybody today was sitting very still, both here and on the screen. So thank you for making such an excellent effort. So the koan today, Ungans, do you have them or not, involves a conversation between Hyakujo, Wang Bo, in other words, asked Ungan, a koan, this is like a classic koan, with your mouth and your lips closed, how would you say it? So he's saying, how would you say it? How would you say it? If you had to keep your mouth and your lips closed, this is like, there are many koans like this. How will you greet a man of the way? Don't use speech and don't use silence. So, Hyakujo or Wang Bo is busy, boxing Ungan in to a conceptual contradiction from which there's no conceptual escape. And Ungan says, Osho, do you have them or not? Hyakujo said, my successors will be missing. So this is like a classic koan about a koan. So, one of the interesting things about the human mind is that even when we are fearful or unhappy or anxious, it can feel in a strange way comforting, partly because it's familiar. I was just hold on just a second. Oh, sorry, just one second. Melanie, you need to mute your phone. Okay, great. That we don't seem to be getting that echo anymore. All good. Okay. Just a sec. Okay, thank you. Okay. So one of the interesting things about the human mind is that it creates a kind of wholeness or coherence, even if we're unhappy or even if we're anxious or fearful. And this is actually quite interesting, you know, and it's a big problem, right? I mean, people who are neurotic may suspect that they're neurotic, and they may even know that they're neurotic, but they may not know how they're neurotic, you know. So people who have, say, a classic example is something like this, is somebody who, you know, basically during the day is constantly going to the refrigerator and eating, you know, like pulling food out of the refrigerator and eating constantly during the day. And the person gets on the scale every morning and sees that he's gained a little weight and says, I have to stop eating so much. And then next day, you know, starts going to the refrigerator and pulling out food and eating food and tries to stop. It says, you know, I have to stop eating so much food. And, you know, maybe makes a resolution, you know, I'm not going to eat any more snacks, you know, and about halfway through the day, it's unbearable. You know, you have to have a snack. And you know, that person might finally in despair, right, go to like a Weight Watchers place you know, go to spend a lot of money on changing his diet or go to a camp for the summer. And, you know, the person may or may not lose weight, but, you know, actually the issue may not be weight, right? The issue may be completely different. You know, there may be a kind of feeling of not being nourished by life, not being sustained or fed by something in that person's life. And, you know, that person could spend years experimenting with, you know, cauliflower diets or melon diets and reading up on nutrition and never guess, right? Never really guess what the issue is, you know, that, you know, a person's eating because the person feels unhappy and unnourished, right? And that might be invisible to that person all that person's life, you know. And, you know, there are other examples of this. You know, when I was in college, one of my really good friends had a sister who had an eating disorder. She was like a bulimic, right? And you know, basically my friend, her brother tried to stage an intervention. And, you know, at first, you know, he told me at first that he thought that she knew she had an eating disorder and just didn't want to hear it from somebody. But, you know, actually she was like this super smart person. And, you know, her arguments were really convincing, you know. But she had an eating disorder. She wasn't aware of it, right? She explained her behavior so lucidly in these other ways, you know, that made the eating disorder issue disappear. So, you know, she, very intelligent person, very like high functioning until this eating disorder became like a huge problem for her. Or, you know, the person who's constantly going to the refrigerator and getting on the scale and punishing himself every day for weight gain when that's not really the issue. You know, it's very hard to detect the neuroses in our life. You know, the unexamined, the things that are holding us back or causing us suffering are all often invisible to us, right? And that's a big problem because, you know, you can hopefully, if you're lucky enough to be able to find a good therapist or go to a therapist, you can maybe work your way out of that. It can take some time. But, you know, often people don't work their way out of these issues. My father was a smoker. In fact, he actually died of lung cancer. And he kept, he knew, his doctor had actually said to him, you know, if you don't stop smoking, when he was in his 50s, his doctor said, if you don't stop smoking, you're going to be dead in in 20 years. And my father tried to quit cigarettes. And finally, he picked up cigars. He switched from cigarettes to cigars, and he would swear he wasn't inhaling. You know, many years later, he eventually died of cancer, you know, but he could not stop, you know, could not stop. And, you know, many years later, I began to realize that, you know, my father started to have like smoking disorder, you could say. You know, when his life became very difficult, his situation at work became very difficult, and he had to make a transition in his job. And that's when he really began to smoke sort of like obsessively. And I remember going into the bathroom and seeing him, you know, smoking while he was shaving. And you know, I tried to stage an intervention, and, you know, it was just like off the table. But, you know, smoking wasn't his real problem. His problem was he didn't have ways of dealing with these feelings of being unappreciated in his work, right? He was working very hard. He was going nowhere in his chosen profession. He was being passed over for promotions. And, you know, he felt very trapped in his life. And you know, smoking was like a temporary pleasure for him. You know, actually, smoking is, if you're a smoker, smoking is like a little bit of a reward. You know, you get a little rush. And so he would reward himself with a cigarette when he was in like emotional distress. And then, you know, he would, you know, be unable to walk four blocks without being winded, you know. So, you know, the mind can create this, like, this cocoon, right? We could create this cocoon around ourselves of like normality, and we can be comfortable there and feel safe there, even if we're unhappy there, right? You know, the mind is actually doing something very good. The mind is always like our ally, you know, in my opinion. And the mind's trying to protect us, is trying to help us, but, you know, it's using tools that aren't necessarily the best tools. It's using what's available and trying to diminish our anxiety or diminish our fear, you know, so smoking is available or going to the refrigerator is available. But that's not the best strategy, and we can't solve the problem if we can't see the problem. So, you know, one of the things that worries me about meditation practice in the United States is that people are maybe not using it the proper way. You know, actually, meditation itself can be kind of like a drug, believe it or not. It can be kind of like that cigarette or kind of like that refrigerator you go to when you're feeling emotional distress, you know. Many people get interested in meditation because they are in emotional distress, and when they sit down on the cushion, they begin to feel better. And this is actually wonderful, right? I mean, in my own life, I had issues with probably low-level depression and caused by like an anxiety disorder. And when I started doing meditation, it definitely helped. It was like I instantly began to feel calmer on the cushion and off the cushion. And I threw myself into Zen because it actually did put me in this very beautiful place, this very calm place. And at the same time, you know, every once in a while, I would like be explosively angry, right? Like explosively angry. And, you know, I saw myself in my early years of Zen practice as becoming like a more and more peaceful person, more and more centered person, a balanced person. And, you know, it wasn't something I got up in the morning and went to the mirror and said, you know, you're a very balanced person, but I visualized myself as on this path, right, towards, you know, becoming like the Dalai Lama, you know, this very serene, very, and I often was serene, you know. But then, you know, every once in a while, I would like have like explosive anger, you know, and people around me didn't normally see it. But sometimes something would, you know, like produce like this explosive anger, and people would be shocked. You know, they'd say, "Where?" You know, they would be surprised, right? I mean, I wouldn't hit anybody, but like there would be like this little explosion of anger. And I remember once I was in the car with a friend of mine, and this person very recklessly cut us off and almost caused a serious accident, right? And I pulled over and got out of the car and started yelling at this person, right? And, you know, it was really, I was really angry and vehement, right? And my friends, you know, were shocked. Like, you know, you're the Zen guy. You're Mr. Natural. You know, you never lose your temper. And she was shocked to see like there was this anger. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that I had these unresolved issues, you know, that I had hidden from myself, you know. And, you know, there were things in my life that, you know, had left karmic traces, you could say, you know, I don't have to go into, but we all have things in our life. We've all been done injuries, right? Injuries, or we feel wounded, or we feel, you know, that we've been assaulted in some way, or mistreated in some way, or deprived in some way. And, you know, what I did, I didn't have a word for. But later, you know, actually in the psychoanalytic community, this was like 30 years later, people began to notice, actually, that there were meditators, like long-term meditators, right? These are people who had been meditating for 20 or 30 years who reported depression. Yeah. And this was actually quite a shock for everybody because, you know, about 25 years ago, people in the psychoanalytic community began to get very interested in meditation, very interested in mindfulness. And there are these scientists at the University of Wisconsin. Davidson is his name. He's a brain researcher, and they wired up all these Tibetan monks, and their brains are very calm, very loving, you know. And so there was this great push in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy to integrate mindfulness meditation into meditation practice. And, you know, it's just generally the case. People who meditate, you know, they're calmer and so on. So, you know, psychiatrists began to report and psychotherapists began to report that they were seeing people who were like long-term meditators, 20, 25, 30 years, who were reporting depression. This was like a shock. You know, it's like, have we been totally wrong about meditation's therapeutic qualities? You know, how can these people be long-term and at any rate, there was a lot of soul searching, but they began to notice that different people were using their meditation in different ways. You know, some people were using their meditation practice to avoid confronting these things in themselves, these old wounds or these sources of anger or feelings of deprivation and so on. They even coined a term for it, which is a wonderful term. It's like spiritual bypassing. And you know, when I read about this, I realized, you know, this is something I had been doing for a very long time in my practice. You know, it took me a long time to realize that I was using my Zen practice to be comfortable and happy by bypassing the things that were difficult to face in myself. right? And I had, like everybody else, I had my share of those. And so it was quite possible after 10 years for me to be generally serene, and then something would happen that would, you know, cause me to go into a panic, and my response to that panic was like fury.
And I've noticed
this pattern even in like I have known some meditation masters, believe it or not, in various traditions who have some of these characteristics. So years ago, I studied, let me just say that my first teacher, Takabayashi Genki, was an amazing human being and somebody I deeply love. And I'm quite convinced he was somebody who had worked through many of his obstacles. But I had a chance to study with another Japanese teacher whose name I will not give you and who is deceased, who had anger issues. It was quite amazing to see this person normally be very calm and very centered. And then if something happened, he would become explosively angry. And he was reputed to have like a people would say, uh-oh, he has a terrible temper. And it's like, wait, he's a Zen master and he has a terrible temper. Where's that coming from? Right? And people around him made excuses for this, right? You know, they said, well, he's enlightened, you know, but he has a terrible temper. It's like, well, I can't imagine like the Buddha yelling, screaming at somebody. That's hard for me to imagine, right? So, you know, I realized that this person too had like issues that were unresolved. And he was like a very advanced practitioner. He was somebody who I believe had a Daikensho experience, you know, a deep. And in some ways, studying this with this person is like going to Zen graduate school, right? I mean, when I did study with him, it was so fat. He knew the mind so well, but he hadn't seen this aspect of the mind, I guess, or this aspect of his mind. So, you know, he was a Zen failure in a certain way. I don't mean as a human being. I mean, you know, his Zen practice left him in a place that was not fully awake because either his teacher or he himself had not used the practice to fully encounter his own inner obstacles, And, you know, even, as I say, even people who have had Daikensho can deceive themselves about this. So if you ever read in the press about, say, a Buddhist teacher, a very famous Buddhist teacher who has had an affair with his student or has done something of that kind, and you think, well, how can that person must not really have been enlightened, right? Actually, it's more complicated than that. That person could have had many deep awakening experiences, but was spiritually bypassing, not encountering what was one of the obstacles. And it's not a black or white sort of situation. A person can be very awake in some context, but still have concealed from himself or from herself certain aspects of her karma, right? Or his karma. So this is like a big dilemma, right? That, you know, even when we feel better, we may be feeling better for like the wrong reason in a certain way, right? If you want to put it that way, that's not quite the right way to put it. But, you know, it's very important in Zen practice to have like a motivation for, I would say, like complete awakening. That the word in Sanskrit is anuttara samyak sambodhi. Anuttara samyak sambodhi. And that actually means enlightenment without karmic remainder. Enlightenment. So according to Buddhist teaching, only one person in the present world age has had anuttara samyak sambodhi, and that was the historical Buddha. And everybody else is striving for that goal, but, you know, not there yet, right? But I think it's important to want to be fully awake, to want to be fully awake, because I would say we all do a little bit of spiritual bypassing, you know. So if Zen practice is just about feeling better, if you're using your Zen practice just to feel a little better, I'm very happy you're doing Zen practice. I think that's wonderful. But on the other hand, I think it's very important to always assume that there's some shadow, some obstacle, some karmic habit that you haven't encountered yet, but it's still there, you know. So, you know, this isn't just an academic issue. I think when we practice, it's possible to reach a place where we're pretty comfortable, where we feel pretty comfortable. And, you know, my feeling is that that's actually sort of this is going to sound a little strange, but that's actually sort of a dangerous place to stay for too long, right? You know, when people first start doing Zen practice, they have, generally speaking, some motivation for getting on the cushion. And that motivation could be anxiety, it could be unhappiness, it could be a sense of longing or loss. Something brings them to the cushion. And, you know, after you sit for just a little bit, you know, after you sit for, say, a couple months, you know, you may find that you do feel much better, you know, much better. And especially if you can enter like samadhi. So when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath, if we're reasonably practiced, you know, after about 15 minutes, you have a deep relaxation response, right? You know, you feel better, relaxed. And then if you do Zen meditation for a while, you know, you'll begin to have, you begin to enter into like these deeper states of consciousness, which can be very serene and very blissful, right? So, you know, if you've been practicing for a couple months, you know, you can come in and get on a cushion and get into samadhi, and samadhi is so sweet and it's so beautiful. You know, it's this blissful spirit, this bliss, you know, it's just great, you know. But, you know, actually a good Zen teacher will allow her student or allow his student to enjoy samadhi for a while, but not to stay in samadhi for too long in terms of one's life of practice. So, you know, people who practice just to enter samadhi, right? Just to enter samadhi. And there's lots of people who do that. Lots of meditators practice to enter samadhi. When they enter samadhi, all problems seem to be gone, right? It's a very beautiful place to be. And you're grounded in the moment. You're calm. All is well, right? And there was a very famous Zen master named Hasegawa. And Hasegawa Roshi used to call this the cave of poison grass, right? Because it's like you go into this beautiful cave and there's this beautiful grass and you can graze on the beautiful grass and you can stay in the cave, but you're not awake. You're not awake. You know, when the Buddha studied with his two teachers, Udraka Ramaputra and Alara Kalama, you know, he learned how to enter emptiness and he learned how to enter samadhi. But he rejected both of those. He said, these are not fully awakened states. This is not Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. And so he went off on his own to practice on his own and began to work through his obstacles. And, you know, in the classical Buddhist literature, it says that, you know, on the last night before the Buddha woke up, he was tempted by the Mara, who is like the devil, the Buddhist devil, this deva who wanted to prevent the Buddha from waking up. sends to the Buddha all of these like temptations, right? These are like stereotype temptations, like worldly power, since he was a male, beautiful women, you know, and so on and so on. And of course, the Buddha, one way of thinking about this is these were all the Buddha's, you know, all the Buddha's hidden desires, all the Buddha's hidden fears and anxieties, right? And so even though it's in a highly mythologized form, one way to think about these scenes is that they're the Buddha's, in order to wake up, the Buddha has to confront all of these things in himself that he had hidden from himself, right? And they're arising one after another and, you know, basically preventing him from fully realizing enlightened awareness, right? So, you know, we all have to practice that way. We all have to assume that we're not awake fully. You know, we're not fully awake. And, you know, even even after you have a Daikensho experience, right? Even after you have a Daikensho experience, you're not fully awake. That may sound shocking, you know. Many people imagine that when they do Zen, it's going to be like this. You're going to be unhappy and confused, and you'll eventually have this experience that will be like the sun exploding in your head, and that's a pretty fair description of great awakening. And then you'll be fully enlightened. But actually, that's not true. You know, after you have a Daikensho experience, for a while you feel like you're fully enlightened, but what happens is gradually you realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm feeling fear. How is that possible? Or I'm feeling anger. How is that possible? So, you know, for an ordinary person, even the experience of Daikensho doesn't clear away all karmic residue. And if you, and I've often said this, if you ever meet anybody, any teacher who says, I am fully awake, please, please just say, thank you so much. Turn around and walk away and never go back. Please never listen to that person. Because that's not Buddhist teaching, for one thing, and that person is deluding at least himself, okay? So you know, after you have had Daikensho, you still have to clean up karma. And so you're sort of, whether you have Daikensho in this life or you don't, you know, you're sort of in the same situation. And that's the situation of not knowing what you have concealed from yourself. You don't know your obstacles, right? You generally don't. Sometimes we do. We know, oh yeah, there's that anger I have, or there's that fear I have. But a lot of our obstacles we don't know. So, you know, one of the things that I think is so beautiful about Zen tradition is this practice of koan training, right? Koan training. And, you know, koans work like, they are, like you could say, a little bit like a mantra, but more, they're more like a subliminal cue, right? It's like maybe some of you are familiar in psychology with what's called a Rorschach blot, right? Rorschach blot. They'll hold up these pictures and they're just these sort of random forms on paper. They're often somewhat symmetrical. You'll show a Rorschach blot to somebody and they'll say, oh my gosh, they're fighting, right? And somebody else would look at it and say something completely different, clouds on a summer day or something like that, you know? So the Rorschach blot is bringing out or helping you to become aware of something that's below the surface of your conscious mind. So, you know, if you look at the Rorschach blot, you know, and you see people fighting, it's because, you know, somewhere you're already fighting, you know, or you're already afraid of fighting, right? So, you know, koans are like a more sophisticated form of this same practice. So you know, basically the teacher will say, If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And you sit down on the cushion and say, give, take, give, take. And, you know, for a while, you might try to figure it out. You might think, okay, well, you give a staff to somebody who has one and you take it away from somebody who doesn't because this is about X. You know, this is about holding on to things. I need to let things go. But it's really not what the koan is about, see. So you could try to solve it intellectually, but then you internalize it like a mantra. You say, give, take, give, take, give, take. You know, and gradually, you know, gradually, you know, something comes up that you couldn't have predicted. And the especially koans that are difficult to work through are working their magic, you know, because you know, sometimes you give a student a koan and it's not really a big problem for them. This is not like a big obstacle for them. So they you know, internalize the koan, they sit with it for a little while and they come in and they give you a very acceptable answer. They've processed this and they've confronted something and they have an opening. But it's been pretty easy for them to do that. And if you answer your koans quickly, please don't feel that's a bad thing. But sometimes it means it's not a big obstacle. Whereas sometimes, you know, you're working on a koan that takes a long time. And you can be thinking, oh, I'm a Zen failure. Why am I not answering? I answered my last koan in 2 days. Why is this taking me 6 months? And the reason is that this taking you 6 months is because this is a really important obstacle that you're not allowing yourself to see. And, you know, so sometimes taking a long time on a koan isn't a sign that you're failing. It's a sign that we've together found something that's really important to work through. It's a lot of clinging or a lot of anxiety or fear there. You know, and you know, little by little, we just keep working through these obstacles that we have, and they're invisible to us, and then they become visible, and then they're invisible, you know, and then we think, you know, it's all whole, it's all solved, and you know, there's still some more work to do, and eventually, you know, it's not you get rid of your obstacles, but something else changes as well. You know, you stop being afraid of obstacles, of confronting things. See, I mean, you know, people sometimes become trapped in lives they don't like because they're afraid of, you know, not having control over their lives. You know, so even if you're unhappy, if you have control, at least you have control, right? It could be worse. You know, the old cliche, the devil you know is better. That's really like a terrible saying, right? In my opinion, right? The devil you know is not good, right? It's not, you know, not good. And the devil you don't know is even worse. So, you know, if you're afraid of being lost or you're afraid of being out of control, you're easily trapped by your fears, right? And I think one of the things that Zen practice does is to, you know, we get into this place with koans where we feel totally boxed in and helpless. And like we'll never be able to work this through. And suddenly there's a transformation. It's like a gestalt change. And we have this, it's like a horizon opens up. And then, you know, that's wonderful. And then the teacher gives you a new koan. And now you're boxed in again. And you're feeling trapped and helpless and lost. And then, you know, you give up and there's this opening, another opening. And you go through this process, you know, 20 times, let's say, or 50 times. And you're a very different person. It's like, you know, I'm not afraid to be trapped. I'm not afraid to be lost. I'm not afraid to be out of control. And, you know, you develop this deep trust in your true nature. It's like every time I've had a koan, I've been stuck. And I've been trapped and I felt helpless. But, you know, every time I've had a koan, something miraculous has happened and presented itself. This opening happened, and I was able to move through this. And that makes you a different kind of person. You know, it makes you a different kind of person. You know, it doesn't have, you know, there's other ways to do this besides koans. In the 100,000 songs of Milarepa, if you know Tibetan literature, you know, when Milarepa came to Marpa after having developed these extraordinary powers, right? He developed these extraordinary occult powers, and he had used them to kill his mother and her lover, and was bothered by this, you know. So he came to study with this great Rinpoche, this great Lama, Marpa, and Marpa, you know, said, "Look, I'll teach you, but first, what you have to do is all these stones out here in the field. You have to take these stones and make a tower out of them. And I want you to make this beautiful, tall tower, you know." And so, you know, Milarepa spent weeks and months, you know, arranging these stones into this cylindrical tower, right? And, you know, all his heart and soul put into this. And, you know, when he was done, he went to Marpa and he said, "Here it is." And Marpa said, "That's great. Now I want you to tear it apart." And Milarepa didn't want to do that, understandably, but he tore it apart. And then when he tore it all apart, Marpa said, "Okay, put it back together again." And, you know, this went on for some time. And, you know, but as Milarepa was going through this process, you know, he was being transformed, building this tower and tearing it down, building this tower and tearing it down. It's not so different from what we go through in our training, in our koan training. So Milarepa came for, you know, he didn't know he came for enlightenment, but he first had to work through all of these obstacles that led him to kill his mother, right, and her lover. And so you know, this was like extended confrontation with everything he had hidden from himself. So another way this happens is in Tibetan tradition, you know, sometimes the teacher will assign the student a deity, right? So you'll be assigned to meditate on a deity, and people think that the deity is this is like a compliment, but often you know, as they begin to work with the deity, they feel very it's like working with a koan, very threatened or challenged or lost, right? And the deity is often, even though it seems like this wonderful thing, it's actually pointing to something in themselves that they haven't wanted to confront, you know. So, you know, it's wonderful to practice to feel better. It's wonderful to practice to feel peaceful. And it's wonderful to feel peaceful, you know. Every time I sit, I feel great, you know, and I've been doing this for 40 years, partly because I feel better after I sit. But, you know, there's a danger in just practicing to cope, right? Just practicing to cope, just practicing to feel better. The danger is that we're not really fully awakening ourselves, you know. So I think it's really important, you know, to say, look, why am I into Zen? You know, why am I doing this? And yes, I want to feel better. But, you know, what I really want to do is wake up. What I really want to do is be an enlightened person. And, you know, I'm not going to be totally happy, you know, until I'm a fully awakened person. And I think that's a a really, that's the perfect motivation for Zen practice. But also, you know, it's a wonderful way to live. You know, it's like, you know, it's like every sit is a different sit. You know, I sit down, I do meditation all the time. And people will say to me, you know, like, how often do you meditate? And I'll say, I meditate several times a day, you know. And they'll say, well, just what do you do? I just sit on the cushion. And doesn't that get boring? And it's like never boring, right? It's always, you know, it's always fascinating, actually, fascinating. And, you know, I am not fully awake. You know, I'm not fully awake, and I've been practicing for 40 years, and I get up every day, and, you know, I'm very happy to practice. In fact, I'm really eager to practice, because, you know, every time I find some obstacle and work it through, my world is a little bigger world. It's like, you know, I'm always looking for my next obstacle. I had Genki Roshi used to say, a Zen person does what other people don't want to do, you know. And I think that's a wonderful, in other words, sometimes doing the thing you don't want to do is actually the best thing in the world, right? Because, you know, you're confronting in yourself a limitation that's sort of self-imposed and arbitrary, you know. Precisely because we can't know what our obstacles are, sometimes doing things that we have distaste for can be really, really liberating. You know? Main subject. Hyakujo asked Ungan, with your mouth and lips closed, how would you say it? Ungan said, Osho, do you have them or not? Hyakujo said, my successors will be missing. Secho's verse, Osho, do you have them or not? The golden-haired lion does not crouch. In twos and threes they go the old way. The master of Taiyu snaps his fingers in vain